already, just to welcome you and to thank you for spending your morning with us. It was a late summer morning in the year AD 70. So about four decades after the death and resurrection of Jesus. And on that summer morning in the city of Jerusalem, the inhabitants woke up to a sound no one wants to hear. It was the Roman battering rams against their walls. They'd been under siege conditions for months, food running out, the wells fouled up, quiet in the streets except for the sounds of starving people, mothers hoarding breadcrumbs, and the relentless noise of the Romans while the priests prayed in a temple they knew might not survive the week. So finally on that morning, the Romans poured in and they set fire to the temple, and the cedar gates were blazing hot. And they came in with their weapons, killing. And the historian Josephus wrote that when they came in that day, that the blood flowed down the temple steps like water. And then what happened in the days that followed was so grotesque. The Romans crucifying up to 500 inhabitants of the city a day, putting them on crosses in really humiliating positions just for sport, killing people to make a point. As the city was burning, the inhabitants were killed. The temple was glowing even at night. It's like the sun just dropped down to earth. That was what the residents of the city of Jerusalem experienced that day. Terrible destruction at the hands of the Roman army. Now, the Romans had waged war before. They'd laid siege to cities before. But during this period in history, no city suffered quite like Jerusalem. Things never got much easier for the city of Jerusalem either. Even in the past century or so, they have faced collapsing empires and rising violence from neighbors, refugee crises, retaliatory attacks, assassinations, raids, bombings. Of all the cities on earth, Jerusalem does not need a stat sheet to remind it of war. It has been ruled over or trampled by, in some sense, by the Egyptians and the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, by Greece, Rome, Ottomans, the British troops, Jordanian troops, more. Peace in Jerusalem is not just unlikely. Historically, it is almost unimaginable. If you were going to pick a place to announce global peace, you would never choose Jerusalem. And yet the prophets did it, and they did it on purpose. About eight centuries before the Roman army destroyed the city, the prophet Isaiah, at the very beginning of his ministry, had two back-to-back visions. The first vision, the very first thing recorded in the book of Isaiah, is doom and gloom. It is judgment and devastation. Isaiah's book begins this way: the vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah saw. And let me just take a moment to summarize the indictment and the vision that Isaiah gives to the residents of Jerusalem. He calls them a brood of evildoers given to corruption. He says that they've turned their backs on the Lord. He tells them, your head is injured and your heart is sick. From head to toe, everything is unhealthy. He says that you're like a shelter in a vineyard, a little hut in a big cucumber field. You are a city under siege. You don't defend the fatherless and the widow. God is not listening to your prayers. Your city is burning, and no one will put out the fire. What a way to start a book. I mean, with that opening salvo, someone might just roll up the scroll and say, "Message received, Isaiah. There's no hope for us." But if we keep going, if we pay attention just a little bit longer, just one more chapter, things change. Isaiah chapter 2 begins this way. This is what Isaiah saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Now let me read you the first few verses and notice the difference. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations, and he will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. This vision, just one chapter over, is radically different. It's still about Jerusalem. It says so right at the beginning. But in the last days, Isaiah says, a high mountain, the Lord's temple, will be established. And everyone, all nations, not just people in Jerusalem, not just people in Israel, all nations will stream to it. And they're not coming for a sightseeing tour. They're coming to be taught. And what will they be taught? Peace and justice. This is about formation. It's not diplomacy or treaties or military deterrence. God will show the nations how to settle disputes and end conflict. And they will take their weapons of war and beat them into tools for human flourishing. That's what you learn on the mountain. Not abstract theology, not a bunch of to-dos or three easy steps to solve your world conflict. It's how to stop conflict for good and foster peace being taught by the Lord. But peace, lasting peace, that sounds very foreign for most of us. We are used to conflict. We've grown up with it. It's just an assumption. I remember being about 10 years old, maybe a little less, and watching the beginning of the first Gulf War live on television. And seeing the conflict played out minute by minute. And learning that the world was not safe. And I had the luxury of waiting till I was 8 or 9 to really figure that out. But I remember several moments as I watched television. I learned, for instance, that there's a war correspondent in an early 24-hour news network with the first name of Wolf. I remember Dan Rather teaching me Saudi Arabian geography, talking about cities like Riyadh and Dhahran. And I remember seeing that as my first memory of real, visceral conflict. All of us have those memories. For some, it might be the attack on Pearl Harbor. Others might point to memories from the Vietnam War. For one generation, their first memory was probably the attacks of September 11th. For some people, their earliest memories of conflict were not way out there. They were in their own home. Maybe it was a child trying to get away from conflict that their parents were experiencing constantly. We all have early memories, and we believe that conflict is just how things go. It's not just out there, right? We have experienced it. It trains us. It forms our instincts and our reactions and our imagination. Some of us learned how to fear before we learned how to trust. We learned how to argue before we learned how to listen. Some of us may have become experts at protecting ourselves, but we're beginners at peacemaking. Back in 2002, a journalist named Chris Hedges set out to answer this question: how much of human history, at least the history that we know of, has featured peace versus war? And he used criteria. You could maybe dispute his criteria or want to use different ones. But he said, a year of peace versus war is defined this way. A year of war would be when there is a conflict involving at least 1,000 combatants and or at least 1,000 deaths in one conflict. And when he used that criteria and looked at history he could observe or read about, he discovered that only 268 years out of the last 3,400 years have been free of war. If you were to condense human history into a single calendar year, only 1 week would be peaceful. 1 week out of an entire year. See, peace is the historical anomaly. War is the routine. And Hedges argues that we don't just outgrow war, we ritualize it. We are shaped for conflict long before we are shaped for peace. And yet, Scripture points to a new reality. Advent directs us to new possibilities. The early church saw this. For the first 300 years or so, until about the time of Constantine, the early church believed that waging war was incompatible with being a Christian. They were even mocked for refusing to participate in battle. Now, I think it's a healthy and good debate to talk about pacifism, which says all conflict, all violence is wrong, versus, say, Augustine's just war theory that says with the right motives and waged the right way, there are some just wars. That's a good and healthy debate. Sometimes I find myself thinking, I'd be grateful if Christians would just have the debate. That we would see war and peace just like everything else in our lives as something subject to the reign of God and something we should test against the Scriptures. Sometimes we treat it as just an assumption. It's going to happen. And if my group does it, it's always good. Scripture points to a different reality. It points to a vision for peace. And it's not just something that we look forward to. It's something that we work to make real, even now. It's one of those on earth as it is in heaven kinds of things. Right now, most of us could list several conflicts. The grinding war that still rages on between Russia and Ukraine, with cities shattered and families all over the place and no clear end in sight. We could talk about the violence that continues in Gaza and Israel and the West Bank, where grief and fear and retaliation seem to keep peace just always out of reach. We could talk about Sudan being torn apart by civil war. We could talk about Christians being murdered in Africa and other places. Even now, the relationship between the United States and Venezuela is growing increasingly strained. If the world were the only evidence, if what we could see was the only reality, we would give up on peace. But Advent gives us a different kind of evidence. One historian who wrote a massive book about Jerusalem ends his book this way. He says, wars are often called forever wars, but no wars are eternal. Peace is possible. It is essential, and it is inevitable one day. Advent says otherwise. The world wants otherwise. If you go to New York City and you look across the street from the United Nations building, you will see a sculpture by Soviet artist Yevgeny Vucevic. He gave it to the United Nations in 1959, and the sculpture depicts a man holding a hammer aloft in one hand and a sword in the other hand, and he is beating that sword into a plowshare, just a tool to till the land for crops. That sculpture is directly inspired by Isaiah's vision of the mountain that teaches nations peace. That's across the street, overlooking the United Nations, where countries go to hash out conflicts. Across the street from that is a sculpture depicting Isaiah's vision. Now, Micah quotes Isaiah, or maybe the other way around, almost verbatim. In Micah chapter 4, this same vision shows up. And when scripture repeats itself, we ought to pay attention. And Micah has almost word for word what Isaiah says, except Micah adds a line. Micah chapter 4, verse 4, at the end of the quotation, he imagines this. Everyone will sit under their own vine, under their own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid. Advent announces the terror from conflict is done. There's a new reality where Cain doesn't kill Abel, where Pharaoh has no totalizing power, where Assyria and Babylon conquer no one, where the Roman army is stopped cold in its tracks, where children in Ukraine don't have to sleep in subway tunnels for fear of bombs, where Christians aren't being murdered in Africa, where little girls in Honduras don't have to be afraid of what might happen to them, where Israelis and Palestinians sit down together for dinner, where the God of the mountain of peace reigns. And no one, not men, not women, not children, no one is afraid anymore. But this isn't just passive waiting. Oh, God, please bring peace. This is active. This is us being taught. And if we don't become the kind of people that God can teach, the world will just keep being the world it is. And our children will grow up learning fear by instinct instead of peace by formation. The world is not waiting on more powerful nations. The world is waiting on a church that can be taught. In the play by the same name, Shakespeare has Henry VI say this after witnessing another argument between powerful nobles. Who should study to prefer a peace if holy churchmen take delight in broils? This is our role, church. If we don't practice peace, no one will. And because of Advent, we're people shaped not by the world's conflict, but by the teaching on the mountain of the Lord, by what Isaiah calls the Prince of Peace. Advent is not just waiting. It is bringing that kingdom of peace into reality now. It's choosing forgiveness instead of arguing. It's choosing resolution instead of bitterness. Every day we make choices to become people who are taught on the mountain of peace, or those who are just shaped by the conflict that goes on over and over again in the world. So our question today, on this second week of Advent, what kind of people are we going to be, and who's going to teach us? Will we be those who continue to be taught war and conflict by what we see around us, and we just assume that's how things are, and that's how they'll always be? Or will we be those who ascend the Lord's mountain and who are taught peace by the Prince of Peace himself? Let's